Session number 30020.
Jeffrey Vines, reel 1. If we start with when and where you were born. When and where you were born.
Where was I born? I was born in Muswell Hill, London, in 1914. I went to a school which had an officer's training corps, which proved invaluable. We took a war officer's exam called Certificate A, and we then went on an officer reserve.
Before we go on to that, could we go back and talk about your childhood a bit more?
Yes.
Do you remember much of growing up during the First World War?
No. I do not know anything about growing up in the First World War, really, because I was born in 1914. I only remember elements after the war. But I remember, of course, my schoolboy days and that sort of thing. I left school in 1932. As I said before, we were on the officer cadet reserve, and this was very helpful to us when war broke out.
What did the officer cadet reserve involve?
Nothing, except you were just on it. I was on it. So was my brother. Both my brothers were on it. But my elder brother, when things were moving more towards war, he joined the Territorial Army. I didn't. I went on to the London University, OTC, and did the same sort of training as we did at school. But when war did break out, we had to register, which we did do, and then wait until we were told where we had to go. And in April 1940, I was sent down to the Citadel in Plymouth to a Coast Artillery Training Regiment. I served for a couple of months on another ranks training unit, which we all had to do. Then I went to OCTU and was commissioned subsequently. I was then posted back to Plymouth, where I was put in charge of a training unit. Funny really, isn't it? And we trained new entries. Then I had the opportunity of going on a instructor in gunneries course, which I did do. That was held in Llandudno. I passed out there, and I was then posted to the North East Coast, based at Tynemouth. My job, I suppose, as an IG, really was to supervise the batteries in that area and see that everything was working efficiently and properly, and taking steps to help them get what they needed if there was any deficiencies or anything. After I'd been there for some time, I was posted on a staff appointment to the War Office, which was very nice in one respect, because I was living at home. I went up to town each day to the War Office, and that was for 9 months. The officer I had in charge, he was an awfully nice chap, and he got posted to the command of a 7.2 field regiment in France. I was then posted to an IG position in Dover, which was really the most interesting posting of all. So I did, I had the same sort of job there, and I did not have anything to do with the 540 regiment, which was commanded by a Colonel Richards, who was a person who took us on our OCTU. I don't think he would have wanted any interference from one of his ex-pupils, but he was an awfully nice chap. The only time being on the staff, of course, I did have staff duties like night duties in the operations room in Dover Castle and that sort of thing. But the only time we really ever had anything, any sort of activity, was when we sunk the Munsterland, which was a German cargo ship who was trying to come through the channel. What happened was that the RAF would give us reconnaissance information. They would tell us, for example, that a cargo vessel of 10 to 12,000 tons had just gone into Le Havre, and it would wait there until there was a moonless night, and then it would come through the channel, hoping to get through. This is what happened with the Munsterland. We had information that had left Le Havre. We then picked it up on long-range radar. When it became nearer, it was picked up on the battery radar of the 15-inch guns. And when it was sufficiently near, the battery was told to engage by our senior officer in the ops room. We engaged it when it was off Cap Grenet. We hit it and sunk it. We had remarkably good radar, in my opinion. It could certainly find the target, but not only that, it could find the fall of shot so that we could direct the guns accordingly. The following morning, RAF reconnaissance went out again and brought us back a picture of the Munsterland sitting on the seabed with its funnels and mast sticking up above the water. So it was a very successful operation. The only other thing I do remember in regard to engagements was towards the end of the war, when the Canadians were coming up the coast, the Canadian 3rd Division that was, and they were mopping up all along the coast, mopping up the German batteries, which again were non-combatant troops. They asked us if we would give them some covering fire against the German batteries there. Bit token it was, I reckon, but nevertheless this is what we did. And we assembled in the operations room of the One Stone Battery at Dover. We had the BBC down there, we had newspaper reporters. It was a bit of a sort of like a holiday almost. We did what we were required. We fired across the channel. We had an Auster spotter plane up to direct fall of shot. And when it was all over, there was obviously ceasefire, and everybody then dispersed. The only interesting thing I found about this was that I was asked afterwards if I would take some of the journalists back to their hotel in Folkestone, which I did do. One or other had their own cars. Someone didn't think he'd got enough petrol, so he said, "Was there a petrol station?" I said, "Yes, there's one at the bottom of the hill in Dover." So we stopped by this petrol station, got out, found it was all shut up, everything was shut up down there. We were standing there wondering what was the best thing to do, when the next moment the house just the other side of the road completely disappeared. We were all covered in dust, you couldn't see. It was the last shell the Germans ever fired across the channel. There were chunks of shell lying in the road, all red hot. No one was hit, no one was hurt, nothing happened. We saw that everything was all right, it wasn't a residential area. And we then went on to Folkestone. Then I went back to the battery. They seemed quite pleased to see me when I got there. And that is really all that I really saw in terms of operations in Dover. But it was a very pleasant time there, and it was nice being in Dover Castle.
Was there any noise to...
Noise on that?
When the shell was?
Well, there must have been, but quite honestly, it just happened, and you know, it was all over before you realised what was happening. I mean, we weren't expecting a bombardment or anything like that. It wasn't like going into an artillery barrage, you know, on a land battle or anything. That's all that happened. And as I say, no one was hit. We were all covered in dust and dirt. I mean, you couldn't see a thing. And that was all. Then it blew away, I suppose. And... left us thinking, well, thank God we're all still here, you know. It was a bit like that. But after that, that was really the end of the war as far as we were concerned. Don't forget, that was at the end of September 1944. So there was still, another 4 months or so of wartime before they finally surrendered in North Germany. And so we were still sort of on duty there, but we didn't have anything to do. And that was the time I told you when we were given the Sheerness pack of beagles. So we decided to do a bit of hunting locally, which was really quite entertaining. But just when it was getting nicely underway, I was then posted to the West Kent sub-district for the last month of the war, and I obviously wonder what on earth the point of it all was and what we were doing. The only thing is, I think, that it took so long to get people demobilised. It was the best part of a year before we were demobilised from the end of the war, and they probably had to do something with someone, even though it wasn't very much. After that, I went back to the job which I had before the war, and that's what happened.
But if we go back to the pre-war period for a while, you'd been in the officer cadets at school.
Yes.
Had you and your elder brother joined the Territorials?
He joined the Territorials, fairly well after he left school, yes.
Had you had any ideas in that direction?
No. He was very keen, my brother. I'd say I was in the London University OTC. I did all this, but I never took it... I won't say seriously. You took it seriously. The only thing is that other people took it more seriously, and I do remember that on both occasions when we went to camp, I won the medal for the best machine gunner. That was with a Vickers machine gun, because we were Middlesex Regiment, and the Middlesex Regiment had been a machine gun regiment in the First World War. But I wasn't over-involved in it, whereas my elder brother was. This is what he wanted, I think. And, that was a difference, but I was still on the officer cadet reserve, so I was still called up as an officer cadet when war broke out. As my younger brother was too, he probably looked at it in the same way. I don't think that in that post-war period, which I remember for various reasons extremely well, that you necessarily thought, you've got to join the army, for example. I left school in 1932. In 1933, Hitler became Chancellor of Germany, and believe me, he made an awful lot of difference to the atmosphere in Germany. I went there in 1934. There was a sort of feeling of joie de vivre about. It was very interesting. I'd never been there before, but the place was beginning to buzz again, and that's what he meant originally, of course, until everything went wrong. I went there with, I'll say, my girlfriend in 1936, when the Olympic Games were on. Now, there was a wonderful national sort of feeling in Germany at that time. Hitler, in spite of the efforts of the International Olympic Committee, still managed to Nazify the Olympic Games. It was interesting being there, although we were not in Berlin. In 1938 was the Anschluss, when Germany annexed Austria. That was the year Eric and I got married. In 1939, war broke out, by which time people were going round. I at one time tried to join the HAC because it was in the city and I was working in the city, but it was full up by the time I applied. I don't know that they, I did, I think, go to some of the, I think it was an anti-aircraft battery or something in Watford, but I don't know whether it didn't appeal to me, but anyway, I didn't. So in any case, I was married, and I just sat and waited to see what happened. And as I say, I was had to register with the War Office when war broke out, and I was eventually called up in April 1940 to go to the Coast Artillery at the Citadel in Dover.
How did you and your wife meet?
How do we meet? I met Erica, quite interesting really, in London at a dancing class. I didn't know she was German until I met and talked to her. And she was born in Charlottenburg in Berlin in 1912. She was there at the time that Rupert Brooke, the poet, was sitting in the Café des Westen in Charlottenburg, writing his poem, Grantchester. And if you read poetry, you will see what a lovely, delightful poem Grantchester is. He wrote about all the villages in this South Cambridgeshire area. It's interesting to think that Erica spent the last 20 years of her life living in the area sort of adjacent to that which he was writing in his poem. Well, that was that. I think I told you about the difficulties, in a way, of being here during the war, although I think she coped incredibly well. But it was 6 years separation, you might say, just after you were married.
Was there much animosity shown towards her?
There was only one occasion, I think, she told me. Someone used to shout at her, why don't you go back to Germany? Which was rather an interesting logistical problem, because how the hell you would have got back to Germany, even if you'd wanted to, I do not know. And of course, she wouldn't have wanted to anyway. But she was investigated to see whether she was a threat to national security. Fortunately, it didn't arise. She wasn't, obviously. But no, after that, there was nothing at all. She had no problems whatsoever, thank God. Our next-door neighbour, this is interesting, she was as good as gold, and she was a Dutch woman. Now, the Dutch might have had some reason to be hostile, but she wasn't. She was very good. Yes, I don't think that arose. No one in the army, which she came across subsequently, had any problems whatsoever. No one did. Well, she'd been here quite a long time. Her children were German. Richard, my son, who was born during the war, when he left school, he went to Sandhurst and was commissioned into the Gunners, and he served with the King's Troop, Royal Horse Artillery, initially, and then when his term of duty was up then, he went into the Royal Artillery Commando Regiment, which was supporting the Marine Commandos. So that's what happened. Otherwise we would perfectly English. The only thing is, I suppose, that because it was wartime, Erica didn't speak German to the children. So none of them became bilingual, and she was completely bilingual.
Did you speak German?
Sorry?
Could you speak German?
I spoke German. I took German in matric. But unless you go to the country, you never really learn to speak it properly. I don't think you're ever fluent. When Erika left school, it'd be about 1929, her grandmother brought her over to England to stay with some cousins so that she could learn English properly, because she spoke English at school. She went back home and after a while decided that she thought it was much better over here, which I can believe it was, because I can't imagine that the Weimar Republic was a very pleasant period in German history at all. And then she thought, well, she'd prefer to come here. So she got a work permit, and she just came over here with a high degree of, in my opinion, intelligence and complete bilingualism. And that's what she did, and that's when I met her.
What was her opinion of the Nazi regime and how the regime developed?
I don't think she had much of an opinion, except... well, we never had... never rose, really, as I recollect it. It happened. I don't think she probably treated it any more differently than, well, her English friends, if you like. The only thing is that when we were there, it always amused me, there was a chap, we went to Amrum, which is the North Frisian Islands, on holiday because her mother was there. We used to go out with him now and again. He had a boat. And she always insisted, I'm certain he's a Nazi, she used to say. Now, I don't know quite on what grounds he was a Nazi. She had a friend, a school friend, who she kept in touch with all her life. She always said, I'm certain Herter's a Nazi. Well, I don't know on what grounds she thought Herter was a Nazi. I mean, we never knew anything about it anyway. And of course, you didn't know too much about the Holocaust until it was over, you might say. You didn't. I don't think we knew anything about it. I mean, we knew about things like Kristallnacht, when they smashed all the Jewish shop windows. We knew about things like that. And of course, we did know that they were persecuting the Jews, but we didn't know anything about concentration camps or anything of that kind. That didn't arise. Whereas we are over here, after we were married, everything was just, I would say, quite normally English. And the children were just brought up as ordinary English children.
How did you find the German attitude towards you when you visited Germany in the 30s? How did you find the attitude towards you in Germany?
No problem at all. Would you like me to tell you something which was interesting? It's got nothing to do with anything in particular, but it might give you some idea. I read a book a short while ago by a chap called Bruff Scott. Bruff Scott is a racing journalist. He was an amateur jockey. He also used to introduce racing programs on television, and he was a biographer. He wrote a biography of his uncle. He called it Galloping Jack. Galloping Jack had quite a distinguished career in the Boer War. And when the war was over, he entered Parliament and eventually became a member of the cabinet. He was Minister of War. He relates how on one occasion his grandfather went for a reception at the German embassy, and he met the German ambassador, who was a Baron von Bieberstein. He tried to quiz the Baron about German naval expansion, because they were expanding their navy very much before the First World War. But the Baron didn't want to talk about this, and he said, no, we don't want to talk about this. Come along and meet my daughter. So Buff Scott's grandfather was taken along to meet the Baron's daughter. You might wonder what the hell this has got to do with anything in particular, but I will tell you now. In 1934, I was invited by two friends to go on a walking tour in the Black Forest. I hadn't been abroad before. It appealed to me, so we went to the Black Forest. In that book next door, I've got pictures of us in the Black Forest. You can see what we look like in shorts and this sort of thing, knapsack. It was beautiful. It's a beautiful place, the Black Forest. We were walking along the road one day, and we saw a truck drawn up alongside, and there were two ladies there selling fruit. So we thought, well, this was a good idea. We'd stop and buy some fruit. They spoke impeccable English. Our German, as I say, was schoolboy German. They were very nice, and one of them told us, she said, I'm the Baroness von Bieberstein, and my father was the German ambassador in London before the war. She introduced her friend, who was the Countess von Zeppelin. So there we were, chatting away. She probably thought we were a bit quaint, being English, walking through the Black Forest. I do not know. And then she said, well, look, I'm having a tea party tomorrow afternoon in the Schloss. She said, I'd be very pleased if you would come along. So we thought, well, this was rather interesting. So we said, yes, we would like to. So we went to the tea party at her home in the Black Forest. They were very kind. They looked after us nicely. We had tea. We weren't dressed properly, but that was, she didn't mind that. We met one or two other people. I remember we met a lot of young people who looked like potential Luftwaffe pilots, that sort of thing. But anyway, when it was time to go, we said goodbye and thank you. And the Countess said, well, look, I've got my car outside. Where are you going? I said, we're going to Freiburg. Or we did. She said, well, I'm going that way. I'll give you a lift. So we all got into a Mercedes, because it would be a Mercedes, wouldn't it? And she took us to Freiburg and dropped us at the station. So we thought we ought to do something. So we said to her, well, look, would you come in and have a drink? So we went into the buffet and sat around the table and we all had a drink. Then she went home. Interesting to think that there were these people selling fruit, presumably to help out with the family income, I don't know. It wasn't long after Hitler came to power. And yet at the same time, they still managed to have a Mercedes to drive around in. That isn't anything in particular, but it was quite an interesting diversion, to say the least of it. It was at that time, 1934 I suppose, that was when Germany was occupying the Rhineland, contrary to treaty obligations, that I met my wife in London. Various things seemed to be what we did got associated with what was happening over there somehow. I don't know why, but it did.
What was the general attitude towards Germany and Britain at the time?
I was probably in a slightly difficult position here, as I had a German girlfriend, but I don't think anything out of the ordinary, except all I know is that bit by bit, as the year went by, one felt that something's going to happen, we're going to have a war. People anticipated having a war. I don't think if we hadn't, my brother wouldn't have joined the Territorial Army, as did a lot of other people. Even I wouldn't have tried to join the HAC, which I couldn't get into when it was full up, so that just shows you what was happening. I wasn't aware that there was any animosity at all towards German people. The people we met when we did go to the Black Forest, or indeed when we went to this other place, Unruh,